What's the picture in your mind of a homeless person? Is it a man named Howard in wire-rimmed glasses wearing a coat and tie with his two little dogs on leashes? Could it be Joe, the saluting veteran who camps out in the woods, who relives what he went through in a foxhole every night when he tries to sleep outdoors? What about the young couple living out of sporty backpacks on a park bench, holding hands and writing love poems? These are some of the people photographer Sharon Rodriguez met when she started documenting homelessness in Johnson County. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm pleased to welcome Sharon to the show to discuss her new book, Homeless, Not Invisible. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Gina.
Well, what inspired you to start exploring homelessness in Johnson County specifically and with your camera?
Well, I'm a photographer, and I was walking in near my home, and I saw a tarp, and I thought the Boy Scouts were doing their weekend thing. Found out later from talking to some service organizations in the Olathe Chamber that I was wrong, that it was people living in the woods, living on the street. And I thought, well, I wonder why. So I started asking questions, not only of myself, but of people around me. Why? So
as a Johnson County resident, I mean, did this somehow change your idea of the place you lived to realize that there was a homeless camp near you?
Yes, it did. But it made me curious about the homeless camp and why an affluent county, the most affluent county in Kansas, wasn't doing something about it, why these people were on the street. So that was some of the questions that I started asking myself. And I thought, well, I've got a camera. In order to solve a problem, I know you have to know that the problem is there. So I started using my camera to take photographs of the homeless so that people would know it's a problem.
Well, you know, that makes it sound, I think, a little bit simpler, like I just took pictures of the homeless, than it seems to be. Just there are hints throughout your book that the process of finding people to document and forging a relationship with them to get their participation, it seems like it was a bigger journey than that.
It was, and you're right, I'm simplifying it. But I first had to gain the trust of service organizations because I went to them to meet homeless people. I wanted to know where they were living, where they camped out, where they walked the streets. And people in the service organizations I went to, like New Hope Pantry and Center for Grace and Salvation Army, said, well, we can't tell you where they are. They were very protective. Now I'm very protective, and I understand that protection. So I met several people from volunteering at New Hope Pantry, at Center of Grace Outreach, and on the street. I would stop people on the street that looked homeless to me.
Well, how did you have that conversation? Because one of the things that struck me is that through the images, I really get the sense that these people don't all look alike. I mean, not that that's surprising, but you have a really diverse group of people. And the idea that there's a way that homeless people look, that you can identify that, is part of what the myth I feel like you're debunking here.
Now it's an intuitive look or an intuitive impression, like the young couple in the book of Bradley and Terry. I was walking on a path that I normally walk, and they were on the park bench. She was laying down. He was holding her feet. And I said, something's wrong there. So I walked up to them, and I said, can I give you a packet of food? Each person that I photographed, I got permission from them to photograph, and I traded either a packet of food that I collaborated with New Hope Pantry to get, or I gave them a coat and sweater, like Sean, that's pictured with Boo Boo.
Well, let's go back to the couple for just a moment. You know, they really tugged at my heartstrings. They're And there's a I thought about why, and I think I know the reason, but we'll get to that. I mean, they're, what, 24 and 26 years old, pretty right. young, and they look healthy and vibrant. Like, I don't, from their photograph, I would think everything's probably going fine, you know? They have sort of sporty backpacks, as I mentioned, but what had happened with them is that they lived, you know, they both worked for the same person and started dating at work and then got in a little tiff with their boss and both lost their jobs.
Right.
I think part of what's poignant about that is just the idea that there is such a huge population also of potentially homeless people, people who are one argument with their boss away from homelessness.
One argument or one paycheck. We all are susceptible. And I think that's part of my motivation to explore and to expose the homeless and what they look like and what they act like. The young couple, yeah, they to the average person, they would look like the sporty out on a Saturday morning walk.
Just hanging out in the park.
Yeah. But I walked up to them and asked them if I could give them food. That wasn't my norm. What I normally did was I would walk up to the folks, or I would walk up to the folks and that I was photographing and let them know. I asked them, do you know any homeless? And they would say, I'm homeless. Or I would meet them through my volunteer work or through Pastor David Willingham.
What made you approach this couple differently?
Because, like I said, there was something that was amiss in my eye.
Like they seemed like they needed help maybe immediately.
Right, right. Yeah, it wasn't normal to see a couple sitting on that bench. And so I approached them, asked them if they wanted food. They did. I didn't have anything with me, so I said, stay here. I'm going to run home. Got my release for them to sign and the packet of food and my camera. And they were still there when I got back. And Terry was in tears. She goes, you're an angel. I said, why? She said, because people have been walking by and haven't even stopped. They wanted people just to smile at them, just to acknowledge them. And that's what I have found through the homeless.
Well, tell a little bit more about how they were living there on that park bench.
They were there waiting for Walmart to open because Terry had an earache and she needed to get pharmaceuticals. They were on this park bench. They had been there all night. Bradley had written a poem. And the poem is still on the park bench. I made sure of that because I clear-coated it. And
she had slept while he kind of watched over her through
yes,
the night.
Yes, yes. And that's what tugged at my heartstring is they were so in love. And it showed. And they chose to not be affected by this work situation and to strike out and do what they could. And they were so great to talk to and so open.
You also, there are a couple of veterans you met who both lived in the woods. What woods are we talking about? I mean, I know you've mentioned that you're protective, and I'd like to understand that better, but what woods are we talking about?
We're talking, I'm not sure. They didn't say anything
right, so
other than
either.
Woods. And a lot of times when I would ask, where do you live? I was told it's a secret, like Sean and Boo Boo. Sean is not a vet, but he's photographed with his dog Boo Boo. So that's why I keep referencing Boo Boo. And he uses Boo Boo as a protector. And I didn't ask from what, because I can't imagine what they go through. I know people are abusive to the homeless. They don't want to look at them. They don't want to acknowledge them. And for someone to acknowledge and to listen to their story, they were appreciative.
You know, I guess the it makes sense that the issue of how you sleep would be a big deal to a lot of homeless people, but that comes up again and again in the stories you tell. And Joe, one of the veterans who's been sleeping in the woods of Olathe, you know, he has this sort of, you know, pretty sad story about trying to go and get help at a church and being told that he was going to hell for killing people when he was in the military, and that, you know, that really like upset him, understandably.
Yeah, and it's an upsetting story. And he was one of those that had really been abused. But I found that the vets were looking for their brotherhood. They were looking for people that had lived like they did in Afghanistan or Desert Storm.
How did they find each other? I mean, they do seem, Joe and I forget.
Jeremy.
They seem to know each other. In fact, Jeremy was kind of in a leadership position in the military and liked to also check on the other veterans while they were sleeping.
Right. And I don't know how they met. I didn't ask that question. I just knew they were very, very close. And Joe had been through a horrendous event, again, that he kept reliving every night. And he couldn't sleep because...
And partly because of being outdoors.
Yes, yes. So it was very hard to listen to, but I chose not to judge while I was talking to each one of the participants in this project.
This whole idea of offering food or clothing in exchange for the photographing, I mean, ethically, that's a complicated one, you know? Just as far as in journalism.
In what way?
In journalism, which I know is not entirely what you're doing, but there's an idea that if you could be seen as like paying someone to tell their story for their participation, that in some way maybe is pressure on them to participate in some way or to tell you something. So the idea of participating voluntarily of free will without any enticements, I guess. It's complicated, though, because these are people who need something.
I saw it that way, that I was providing them something they didn't get on a daily basis, and that was food, primarily. And I asked permission before I even started interviewing and got a written waiver. I made it very clear what I was doing, and they had free will. And I have had some people that said no. I had a woman, a really beautiful 73-year-old woman that I met, and I said, gee, I want to photograph you and tell your story. And she said, oh, no, you can't photograph me. My kids would be horrified to see my photograph as a homeless person. And I said, well, why don't they help you? And she just kind of mumbled something. So it was embarrassing to her to be homeless. And so if they said no, I didn't take their photograph or write their story.
There's one guy who gave you sort of a nonverbal cue that he was okay with you sharing his story. And that dynamic is so interesting. He was hanging out at tennis courts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the tennis court is by a park, and he walked that tennis court every day, and he would walk through the park. And I was so excited to see him, I ran up to him and started talking to him, and I said, hey, I'm doing this documentary. He said, I don't want to talk to you. And I said, okay. So I backed off, and then I saw that people were putting food on a table that was designated as his table. And he would pick up the items at the end of the day. So I left a packet, went away for a couple of weeks, didn't walk that park. And then I went back and I saw that he was carrying the bag that I had dropped off. So to me, that gave me permission to take his photograph. And in fact, when I started photographing him, he walked towards me, not away from me.
What did that feel like to you?
It felt like I was gaining a trust that hadn't been there. And that's what I wanted to do with the homeless, was to gain their trust and to portray them with dignity and integrity.
I'm curious whether your sense of what it means to be homeless has changed in the course of having all of these really pretty intimate conversations, from what I can gather. And like an image of homelessness, you know, a lot of people might picture someone under a city bridge or something like that. You're talking about tennis courts and park benches, you know?
Right. And so, yes, it has changed my definition of homelessness. I started out wanting to photograph people on the street, people living in their car, and people couch surfing. So far, I've photographed two of those categories. And each person has given me a bigger glimpse of what homelessness means. And it's not always fun, like Randy and Lester that sleep in their car. They don't want to be there, but they were inundated with medical bills and didn't know what else to do.
Another couple in this case.
Another couple, correct. And they're featured in the book. And they said it cost more to be homeless than it did to have their own home.
What did they mean by that? Do you know?
No, I don't. It was a statement that they made. And what I believe it means is that it cost a lot of money to run the car for gas. Gas is not, I mean, it's cheap to some people, but to them it wasn't. Finding a place to park every night was a challenge because the police often encourage folks to move on. So that's what I believe it means.
What is your, do you have much sense of the history of homelessness in Johnson County? You started out with this question about how can this be happening here. Do you have a more complete answer to that question?
I have some research that I did early on in the project, and it was because I went to a meeting at the Commission on Aging, and they were showing a photograph of homelessness in the Depression era, and they showed a home, a poor farm that Olathe had.
What is a poor farm?
The poor farm was where people were sent when they were down on their luck and couldn't live in their homes or take care of themselves. And some had mental illness, but the poor farm was self-sustaining. They grew their own food, they took care of themselves, and that disappeared. And I wanted to know where it went. Well, now it was at 119th and Ridgeview. Now it's a group of government offices, because I think people thought the need was gone for needing to shelter and house the homeless.
So is your idea of Johnson County now different from the one that you had when you were surprised that that wasn't a Boy Scout tarp?
Yes. And what I mean by that is I'm looking at agencies differently and trying to figure out how the homeless can get information about food kitchens. There are places that serve food. And there are, like New Hope Pantry, there are places that give food every day, packets of food and bedrolls or whatever they can. They also subsidize people at some of the local motels, or around the area. So I'm finding out much, much more about homelessness than I ever thought I wanted to know when I was taking that walk and saw the tarp.
The images of people in this book, they're all accompanied by a brief story that you've written up, and it looks like it's your handwriting, I'm guessing.
It is.
Why that choice? I mean, it seems like you're creating this sense of immediacy, or just one person telling another person's story after a short conversation. I mean, what are you going for there?
Well, I wanted to humanize show that each homeless person had their own story. And you're right, I handwrote the story as a way of, I handwrote the story from the interview. And so it is my words. But the next step is for me to interview the homeless and for them to tell us what they need.
Sharon Rodriguez, thank you so much for sharing this project.
Thank you.
Sharon's book is Homeless, Not Invisible. It's a collection of stories and photographs of Johnson County's homeless population. I'm Gina Kaufman. When KCUR Central Standard returns, another artist with his book. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my next guest on KCUR's Central Standard is Grant Snyder. He's a comics artist living in Wichita who got his start in the Kansas City Star. His work now appears in the New York Times Book Review and the New York Times Magazine, and he's out with a new book, The Shape of Ideas. It's a humorous recounting of the trials and tribulations of the creative process, as well as the pure ecstatic joy creativity brings, but mostly the trials and tribulations. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Gina.
At this stage in your career, like with the level of accomplishment that you've achieved, some people, I mean, I would probably think this guy has got it figured out. But your book is full of the kind of, I don't know, self-doubt and neurotic hand-wringing that we might associate with like a fledgling artist.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like the more work I do and the more I think I figured it out, the less I have, because, you know, early on in my drawing career, if you could call it that, everything was exciting and new and everything seemed to be working. And then you get to the point where, okay, I've tried that before, it worked. It's maybe not as exciting to try it again. I have to invent a new way to solve a problem, to state an idea, to make a comic. So each time it's basically like, you know, becoming a beginner once again.
Is there also a different kind of pressure associated with doing something at a high level professionally that, I don't know, that you aren't kind of burdened with expectations early on?
Oh, absolutely. It's kind of like performing a play with your friends as a kid versus, you know, performing on stage in front of an audience. When I first started drawing comics, I knew that maybe 5 or 6 people would read them, and that was good. I enjoyed that. Now I try not to think about how many people could potentially read one, because that becomes a little bit of pressure to have that ready audience who's seen what you've done before, who's a little bit familiar with what you can do. You definitely don't want to let them down, and that, I guess, creates a level of pressure in a way.
Going back to some of the earlier stages in your career, there's a page in this book, The Shape of Ideas, and each page kind of breaks down some different, thought process related to creativity, to putting something out there. And one of the pages is Making the Leap, and it says, it's got a guy on a high dive, and he starts by saying, I'm not ready, and then it's an impossible task. The pool suddenly drained. It could be painful. Then the pool's full of people having fun. There's too much competition. There are a lot of clouds, and I can't see what's going to happen. Then there are no clouds, and I can see exactly what's going to happen. Then I'm comfortable right here, followed by conditions aren't ideal. And then suddenly it's nighttime. No one's around. The stars are out. And finally, what was I waiting for? Can you tell us what that means in your life, like what the story is there?
Yeah, I love that comic or that page specifically because it works in a few different levels. One is the literal level. I've actually have a slight fear of heights and water as well, and have, you know, the moments as a kid when I was absolutely terrified to go off the high dive. So I think it obviously sprung from that. But on a more metaphorical level, that's it's kind of what I feel, one, when I sit down to the new page every week to make a new piece of work. And two, just at certain points in my career, I felt, okay, I know what I need to do, and I know what I really, you know, deep down want to do, but I'm creating all these excuses that are keeping me from doing it. And ultimately, when I find the, I don't know if it's determination or just, you know, kind of letting go of those things holding you back, and I'm able to make that leap, I realize it really wasn't a big deal, and I just should have done it without all the negative self-talk beforehand.
Is that something you figured out how to do?
At times, I feel like in a weekly sense, I no longer have that fear that, okay, I'm not going to have any ideas to when I sit down to make something. I used to have this this lingering doubt that, you know, well someday I'm just going to run out of ideas, and then there's not going to be any more comics because, you know, I'll be done. I now realize that's never going to be the case.
How do you know that? That's because I guess I'm not trying to imply that might be the case. I'm just saying, at what point, what let you know that this wasn't a finite idea supply you had?
I think what's comforting to me is I've kept a sketchbook for about half a decade or more. And so I have all these sketchbooks in storage. So, you know, say there was a week where I sat down and I really had nothing. I have this built-in almost memory database of, okay, this is something I found interesting and funny enough to put down in a sketchbook. Let's bring this back and rework it. So it's almost like I could revisit my past thoughts or my past ideas and kind of reimagine them. So that's comforting in a way.
You've got a stash.
I have a stash, yes. More ideas I could ever draw in the course of a lifetime. And you know, that doing it that way wouldn't always work, but I also find comfort in the fact that, okay, I've basically drawn a page a week for, you know, for that half decade period or more. You know, it's not something that I'm just going to stop doing.
And that making the leap page, I was wondering if that might also be the leap into the world of professional comics period. I mean, your background is kind of an unusual one for an artist. Most artists do have a day job, but yours is orthodontist. You went to dental school.
Right, in Kansas City at UMKC.
Yeah. How did you juggle these two aspirations, these, you know, the artistic goal and the professional goal, which started out being a little bit separate?
Yeah. One of the interesting things for me is I never had a time when I was like, okay, I want to be an artist, but first let me be a dentist. And I also never had a time that when I was like, okay, I want to be a dentist, but I'm going to do this art thing and see if it works out first. They both kind of developed in unison. I think if I wouldn't have had those 10 or so years of sitting in classrooms aimlessly doodling, I wouldn't have had the freedom and kind of the need for the escape to develop my art and to, you know, to make it into something that was, could almost be called a professional art practice. So I'm not sure exactly how it happened. I kind of kick myself every day that they both have worked out pretty well so far. And yeah, and I hope they continue to kind of inform and support each other, because it's been a very good balance at this point.
Is orthodonture, is that artistic?
It's very visual. It's very detail oriented, which I think it shares some, you know, some qualities of comic making and art making in that way. And it's also very procedure oriented, which the actual, the physical process of making a comic strip is, you know, you have to kind of stick to a routine. So they're similar in that way. But I've made the joke before, people don't really like when you try to get creative with their smiles. there are definitely certain boundaries and things you want to meet. So it's not creative in that sense, but I do think it shares some of the visual characteristics, which I'm drawn to in both jobs.
And a sense of line.
Yeah, absolutely. Line and order and symmetry and, you know, all those things that I guess the ancient Greeks cared about, you know, when they were talking about art.
Early on, though, it was very early on that there were signs that you could make it as a comics artist if you wanted to go that route. You won a really big award when you were still in college.
Yeah, I won the Charles M. Schultz College Cartoonist Award when I was a dental student at UMKC. And that was an amazing experience. First off, it was a $10,000 award, which I have no idea what business they have giving that to a college cartoonist, but I, you know, that was amazing. I got to visit the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., and I met Snoopy and, you know, some other titans of journalism. Yeah.
Did you guys hang out on the roof of his doghouse?
Oh, I wish. That would have been amazing. Snoopy was actually, a woman in her, you know, mid-40s, and she was very friendly. And anyway, I don't think the other, you know, Paul Krugman of the New York Times and the other, you know, journalists there did not get to meet Snoopy, but I felt special in that way.
Yeah, I think you should. But so as someone who has just come out with a book about the creative process and the kind of self-doubt that comes along with it, I'm curious about what your process is. How do you make creativity work in your life?
For me, it starts with the sketchbook, which there are a number of comics in the book about, you know, keeping a sketchbook. To any person who makes art on a daily basis, it seems kind of obvious, but it wasn't until I discovered that, okay, I need to have this place to put down stray thoughts or random doodles and return to them at a past time, that I, you know, that thing started to click with me. From that sketchbook, I'll sit down and try to do at least one new thing to publish a week. I put most everything I make online, which is amazing because I can get an immediate response to it, but it also creates this immediate pressure. Okay, I posted this last week. I haven't posted anything for about a week. It's now time to, you know, to have something else new to say. So I kind of work on a single page over the course of a week, you know, doing the line work, doing the writing, doing the editing, doing the coloring. And when I feel like it's something worth putting out for the world to see, I'll post it on my website, every social media platform ever invented. And then I sell them as poster prints, and hopefully someday every single one will be, you know, collected in another book or future books of my comics.
There's that old saying about genius being 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration or something like that. And you have your own spin on that, which is that genius is, you know, a total of 30% both of those things, and then that it's all this other stuff on top of it, concluding with 0.1% pure elation. It's a very small percentage.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's probably pretty accurate. I think those moments of like pure inspiration where it feels like it comes, you know, from on high or from, you know, the ghost of Thomas Edison visiting or wherever, those are few and far between. The actual creative process is more of all those other things I list in that comic. It's aspiring to have your work seen and liked by others. It's sitting in contemplation and not being with your smartphone and you know, spending some time alone with your thoughts. It's being frustrated about your inability to make, you know, something you're happy with every single time. And then it's imitating other creators' work who you love and trying to do something just as good as they did. And then before the pure elation panel, it's 10.9% desperation of, and that's that pressure of, okay, I haven't said something new. I haven't done something great in a long time. How do I do this again? And then somewhere in the middle of that, there will come those pure moments of pure elation where everything's flowing and everything's beautiful and, you know, the sun's shining down your drawing table. And if you can at least be there to capture those moments, that's when the creative process is just a complete joy.
Can you describe those moments a little more concretely? I mean, metaphorically, sunshine is coming down, but what is so joyful? What is so joyful?
I think for me, it's because it feels like I'm not the one doing the work. So it's hard for me to get out of my head in a way. And when I've stumbled on that idea that, or that, the phrase or the image that I know is going to turn into something bigger. It almost feels like it's been, you know, it's just bubbled up and I haven't had to reach for it. It just arrives. I know that seems kind of mystical in describing it, but that's been my experience with it.
I've heard some writers say that it's like at a certain point, something starts to write itself, that it feels like, that it's just,
oh,
happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wonder.
Yeah, anytime the writing can come without the normal strain, I think that's something every writer is trying to achieve every time they do their work.
This might sound like kind of a glib question, and I don't mean it that way at all. But with 0.1% pure elation and all of these other struggles that go into it, why do it? What is your personal motivation? Do you know?
I try not to ask that question. right now, I think it's habit. But for me, it's also the thrill I get from just seeing lines and colors on paper, and having an avenue to express express things that I can't express in daily conversation, or, you know, that you wouldn't necessarily talk to a friend about over lunch, or talk to your wife about it or husband about it at the dinner table. It's a way for me to be expressive in lines and pictures, like I said, and then to try to say something deeper.
What do you think it is about the creative process that made you want to create a book about that and give people who either are themselves artistic in some way or maybe are outside that a window into what happens behind that curtain?
That's a good question. You know, I love reading books of inspiration and creative motivation, but I feel like a lot of times they're missing something. I feel like, you know, as someone who does creative work, a lot of times they're missing kind of the reality of the creativity, which is not that pure inspiration and not that pure motivation. And those things are great and they're necessary, but I also like to talk about, okay, this is what it feels like when it's not working. This is what, you know, creative block it feels like, and this is how you get out of it. I think it's much more interesting to focus on maybe the more difficult parts of it, and then making a solution and finding a way to overcome those.
You carve out time to do this early in the morning, you know, before you go to be an orthodontist, and you have sleeping wife and children in the house while you're doing this. Is this part of what it means to you to be creative, to wake up early and have that quiet time? A lot of people work very differently than that.
I think the waking up early part is somewhat, I mean, it works for me, but it's somewhat irrelevant overall. I think the main time is just every person who wants to be dedicated to a creative pursuit has to find an undistracted time where they don't have the normal things of the world coming in to pull them away from, you know, from their piece of art, from their piece of music, from their woodworking, from their cooking. For me, that the only hour I can really salvage that is that early morning hour. But for some people, it could be over their lunch break. It could be, you know, and an afternoon nap. It could be late at night. It's just when you can spend the time alone with your thoughts and not let those outside distractions enter in. And if you can't find a time to regularly do that and consistently do that, it's going to be very, very difficult to end up making a body of work.
What time did you wake up today?
Unfortunately, at 5:30. I didn't set an alarm because I'm not working at my orthodontic job today. I was trying to sleep in, you know. I woke up at 5:30 with some ideas for a picture book proposal I'm working on. And there I was down at the drawing table back, you know, in my normal weekly routine.
Well, Grant Snyder, I hope you get to take a nap today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for talking to us. Grant's book is called The Shape of Ideas. Next on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll go on a journey into sound to find out what it's like to learn to hear after more than a decade of deafness. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. A generation ago, if you were experiencing hearing loss and you'd already gotten all the help you could from hearing aids, there wouldn't be much else to try. That's changed. Today, there are cases where people with deafness can hear again with help from cochlear implants. But regaining the ability to hear isn't as simple as flipping a switch. It can take years for the brain to relearn hearing once the digital devices are in place, as Rob Jefferson learned when he got the implants a few years ago. Here's Rob's story of hearing loss, followed by his fascinating journey back to the world of sound.
We went to Paris for our 30th anniversary. If you're familiar with pictures of Notre Dame, you have this wonderfully gorgeous church and these two bell towers that stick up. And I couldn't tell you how many actual feet in the air you are, but we were directly on top of Notre Dame. Standing there, looking out over Paris, seeing the Eiffel Tower in the distance, all of it, to me, was perfect. But when the bells rang, my wife asked me if I heard the bells. And I told her, no, I can't hear them, but I could feel the vibrations. I knew they were ringing, but you're standing directly on top of the bell tower with these huge bells right there, and you can't hear him. You know something's wrong. So that's when I really started looking into alternatives. Music was a big part of growing up. Starting in the fifth grade, I started playing saxophone. I listened to everything from classical music to the pop, the country, the rock of the day. I first started to notice a loss in my hearing in my late teens, probably about 18 years old. Once I got into late 30s, early 40s, music appreciation and understanding had gotten to the point where I just couldn't even listen to music anymore. I couldn't understand it. I found myself spending time at home. I wouldn't leave the house. I would go to work. I would come home, and that was it. My social life pretty much stopped. It just became too much of a chore to go out and talk to people. That's when I really started, thinking, am I going to be like my grandfather, spend the rest of my life in my recliner just watching TV and that's it? So 2 weeks after the surgery, I go back to the audiologist. The audiologist put everything together, and she told me that she was getting ready to turn them on. And she said that once she turned them on, she would let my wife speak first. The audiologist wanted to make sure that the first sound I heard was my wife. Unfortunately, I probably upset my wife, because once they turned on the processors, the first thing my wife said was, I love you, but I couldn't really understand what anybody was saying. And then slowly, I heard a word, and it's like I understood that. And then I picked up another word, and then another, and then it all started falling into place. The only thing was, is it wasn't a natural sound. Everything to me sounded very robotic. I tried to explain it as if you'd ever listened to Styx growing up, their song Mr. Roboto. That's what it sounded like. I have heard people tell me that the first voices they heard sounded like Mickey Mouse on helium. I've had others say that everything was Donald Duck. Even had one gentleman tell me that everybody that spoke sounded just like Darth Vader.
The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant.
To me, that would be really cool, but I had the robot.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
For people that I meet,
what can I do for you?
For the first time,
did you see that?
The voice may still have a little bit of a digital edge to it, but over time, that
How's
normalizes
it
out. It's just the brain learning how to take that signal.
Can you tell me what time it is?
And apply it to what it remembers sound is supposed to sound like. I do remember coming out of the audiologist's office, and there was a tree, and I couldn't figure out what I was hearing. My wife happened to be with me at the time, so I asked my wife, what am I hearing? And she said, describe it. So I did the best I could on describing it, and she just pointed at the trees. She said, well, just look up. It's the birds. And I actually stood there for a couple minutes watching the birds chirp, sing, because I don't think I'd actually heard birds since my early 20s. So to be able to hear that again was really, I guess, moving, emotional for me. A lot of it has just been discovering things as I go along. I believe it was that first winter. I went out to shovel snow, and I walked out and the snow crunched under my foot. And I'm sure everybody else is used to hearing that. I had never really heard it. So I ended up walking up and down the driveway, listening to the snow crunch under my feet. Of course, that made shoveling a little more difficult after I packed all the snow down, but still, it was a new sound, new sensation. It is very, very tiring when you first start off with this because you do have all of this input, all of these sounds that you haven't heard or haven't heard for a long period of time. They're all there, all at once. And mentally, it's exhausting to try to sort through all those sounds and get them all to make sense again. I actually was rather anxious about listening to music. Voices weren't perfect yet, and I was really kind of afraid, if I turn music on, am I going to be completely disappointed? And I would say it was probably a couple months after the processors were turned on that I actually sat down to try to listen to music. It was a struggle at first. I couldn't distinguish a guitar from a drum. They all sounded the same. And then I thought, maybe I'm just trying to listen to music that's too complex. So I backed way up and went to very simplistic music. And the song that actually came across and I could understand the vocal and the instruments, this really dates me. Love, love me do. You know I love you. With the Beatles, Love Me Do. It's just a simple three-chord song. The percussion is very simple. It's a nice, easy song. And I knew at that point that music can come back. I haven't started playing music again. I still have my saxophone. And I still look at it from time to time and think, well, maybe I ought to pick it up and see if I can still make music, but I haven't worked myself up to that yet. There's probably a whole lot of stuff left to do. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to get the music to come back, but it's getting there. It's getting much, much better. To admit, it's getting better.
That story by KCUR's Alex Smith just won a prestigious National Journalism Award, the Edward R. Murrow, for its use of sound. Congratulations, Alex. You can get back to this story, listen back to it, or anything else you heard on this morning's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. We talked to photographer Sharon Rodriguez about her book documenting homelessness in Johnson County and comics artist Grant Snyder about his book on creativity. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tune in tomorrow for a food show all about Middle Eastern cuisine in Kansas City. That'll be an encore presentation. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it. I used to be cruel to my